Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast, connecting you to the world of investing and helping you stay ahead. Portfolio Manager of Fidelity Global Consumer Industries Fund, Annetta Winimko, joins us today from London, England. The global consumer landscape has changed dramatically over the last year and a half. Online shopping, grocery delivery, and streaming services, for instance, soared during the pandemic. But with many major economies now reopening, consumer trends are evolving as more people choose to spend their money on entertainment and leisure travel. With host Pamela Ritchie, today, Annetta looks at current trends in terms of values, lifestyles, preferences, and savings. Annetta shares that the middle class in China has been growing and continuing to grow. Annetta looks at the growing trend globally away from fast fashion, instead with a focus on high-quality clothing that can be owned longer or resold. Annetta also shares that consumers globally are ready to spend more after saving money during the pandemic, but it actually hasn't been easy as there have been supply chain bottlenecks and shortages of products, as well as labor problems in manufacturing countries such as Vietnam. Looking ahead to the upcoming holiday season, Annetta jokes that shopping in October may be a smart decision in case of continued shortages of certain products. This podcast was recorded on September 24th, 2021. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Hello, and welcome to Fidelity Connects. I'm Pamela Ritchie, here to share her insights and discuss the opportunities she's seeing across the global consumer sector. We're very happy to be joined by Portfolio Manager Annetta Winimko. Welcome to you. Great to see you again, Annetta.
Hello. Really good to see you as well.
Annetta, I wonder if we can begin with one of the hugest players, one of the biggest consumers on the planet, which is China. And it looks like their economy is slowing. Overall, how is the Chinese consumer at this moment?
Oh, Chinese consumer. That's on everyone's mind, together with Chinese government. A slowdown of consumption in China has been happening for a while now. The economy has been slowing for a while now. And more recently, we have seen all these regulation measures taken that also have shaked our confidence as investors in the Chinese capital market. What we are seeing in China is there are several trends that are quite well entrenched, and one of them is premiumization. The Chinese middle class has been growing and continues to grow. And I suppose many of you have heard the common prosperity phrase, which now everyone is discussing, because that's the idea of the Chinese government. What they would like to achieve is better wealth distribution. That doesn't mean redistribution of wealth. That what they are trying to achieve is to eliminate the main sources of pain, the three mountains that the Chinese consumers have to climb. And this is property, or very expensive property, healthcare, and education. And they are doing it kind of their way. They are doing it by just banning things. And that obviously creates lots of fear. Talking to my colleagues in China, they are all very hopeful, and they all think that these are the right measures taken for the long term, and those measures should really benefit the Chinese middle class. And what I've seen in my career of years now going to China and meeting with Chinese companies is that they have very strong appetite for good quality products, partially because they have been deprived of those, or their parents have been deprived of those high quality products. They like luxury goods. They like whiskey is selling really well in China, and single malts are growing really strongly. So we are seeing overall slowdown, but the underlying trend of premiumization continues to be there and continues to I think be the major driver of consumption in China.
We are talking about inflation everywhere. I wonder if we can sort of apply it there. Premiumization. I'm saying that wrong, but in any case, you know, better quality things.
Exactly.
Are we all willing to spend more? I mean, do consumers globally, including in China and everywhere else, are consumers ready to spend more? Will they spend more? Is there inflation in consumer goods that you see that will continue?
Well, consumers, especially those in the United States, have been quite fortunate and they have accumulated quite a lot of excess savings. And obviously, today, many of us are trying to spend at least some of it. It's not so easy. There are shortages of products. Myself, we've been trying to buy furniture and delivery maybe next year. So yes, I think consumers have appetite to spend, but it's not easy. We have bottlenecked in terms of transportation, labor issues in places like Vietnam. A natural outcome of that is that prices will move up. But I think it's an adjustment. We have been in unprecedented, difficult situation that has created major bottlenecks. Now we are in a situation where the savings are there and people are willing to spend, because I think the mood has massively improved and the confidence is actually quite high in the West. But it's not so easy because the availability of products is not easy. I've heard companies saying that there could be issues with the availability of products for Christmas. So I suggest making Christmas shopping a priority, maybe in October. I think this is the situation where we are. But I think at the same time, speaking to a lot of companies, they don't really want to massively hike prices, because obviously that might damage demand further down the road. So they are trying to do all that they can. They communicate with us investors. They warn us about the cost pressures and the issues that they have. But I think there is a resistance on company, kind of at company level, completely pass through these costs, which they also think are quite one-off. They don't, like, transportation has not been an issue before. And in a year or two, I don't think we'll have this as an issue. So I think everyone is trying to act rationally in this unusual situation.
Yeah, it's such an unusual situation. What about some of the supply chains, the discussions of a more sustainable approach to stuff, to things like apparel that we like to buy, but ultimately there seems to be a movement to perhaps better quality, but less, or I'm thinking of kind of the fast fashion world. What sort of trends are you seeing there? Are there any examples of companies that you think are doing some of the right things that you can share with us?
Yes, I think fast fashion is a business that came up on the back of declining prices, cheap labor from the East, low cotton prices, and that allowed the fast fashion to develop. And I think that needs to change. Prices of apparel will go up. They might go up because cost of labor, maybe raw materials, but more importantly, they will go up because of the very high environmental cost of making apparel. And today we have a lot of companies trying to source sustainably. They talk about recycled materials, especially polyester or cotton. But at the same time, I think consumer, especially the young consumer, is not necessarily in the mood of buying and throwing away. I think people are actually being shamed on social media for doing that. And there's an incentive to actually, I think, kind of peer pressure for the young kids to buy secondhand. And for example, Lululemon has launched in their stores a program called Lululemon Like New, where one can bring back used apparel, maybe not completely damaged by used, and the company will buy it back, give you a gift card, and then sell it to maybe someone else for much lower price. So the circular economy is something that I think consumers are buying into, and will demand. So fast fashion, I think, is something that needs to evolve to survive.
It's interesting, and it would. I mean, the brand itself, if it's able to say that it's doing this, it's useful on some level.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because it's quite difficult to do it for apparel. But Lululemon can do it because the quality of the apparel is very high. They pride themselves on doing all the research and having the best raw materials. The quality allows them to actually buy and resell the product.
Fascinating. Let's go to the area of food, beverage, maybe restaurants. We've talked a lot about goods and maybe not enough about services. And that's sort of been the story of the pandemic a little bit too. We were able generally to get stuff more easily than certain services we'd like to go and spend our money on because that requires leaving our homes. How is that coming back? Is it fits and starts or does it have some real robustness to it now?
I think it's just coming back. I think people are hungry. They're going to restaurants
for good food. Yeah, I'm sick of my tuna fish sandwiches. That's for sure. Yeah,
there's only so much you can enjoy home cooking. In London, I was recently talking to someone who owns a very high-end restaurants like Zuma, and they said that actually the overall sales of their restaurants are above 2019. Maybe the table turnover is not as high, but once people go out, they really spend and they really enjoy themselves. So, and you know, UK, we are still kind of in, I don't know which wave of COVID. I think people are traveling, people are going out. It is happening. And obviously vaccination has made a big difference. And those that are vaccinated, I think, are much more comfortable. And maybe those who are not, they just don't care. So in either case, they are going out.
Yeah, we spoke, I think, a few months ago about still within the overall discussion of sort of food industry and perhaps beverages. And we talked about coffee. Absolutely. It's a soft commodity at the end of the day, and it has its own sort of supply chain discussions. Maybe we don't hear about coffee as much as we hear about copper and other, you know, metals and so on. But coffee would have to be sustainably sourced in a more serious way by now. Can you update us?
Yes, yes. Obviously, it has been quite a big issue of very low coffee prices, which we saw for a number of years. Because when the prices are so low, it's very hard for the farmers to invest in sustainable sourcing. And companies like Starbucks or Nestle, they kind of go all the way to the farmer and they try to help them and they work with them and they come up with ways of farming that are sustainable. But the fact that coffee prices have moved up, I think, puts the companies which are very close to the farmer and to the supply chain in a better position because they continue to source and now the higher prices allow kind of more sustainable growing of coffee, which obviously is important.
Where does coffee generally come from? The supply chains are all over the world. I mean, I'm just trying to think, yeah. You know, managing the supply chains in countries in a moment of COVID, like it's a tricky thing.
It is, but it has, we are not dealing with shortages of coffee. I guess it's the general move in soft commodities that find, but coffee has been, the prices have been below the production cost. So this adjustment was something that had to happen. Otherwise, there would be a point where farmers would stop growing and then that would create quite serious issues. So I think it's a bit of a natural adjustment in this case.
I'm spending a lot of time on this because I have to think about what I'd give up if I had to pay more for coffee. And this coffee's going nowhere. It's staying.
You know, coffee, when you buy Starbucks coffee, the coffee beans, it's really a few percent of the price of the coffee.
Right,
and
right.
The barista, the shop, this is what you're paying for.
Fair enough. Let's go to, I mean, a massive name on so many different luxury brands. And, you know, luxury is always an interesting area. I wonder if anything is adjusted. Luxury usually holds up in recessions, actually, because the wealthy tend to hold on to their money and are able to continue spending on some level. Has any of that changed? Take us through some of the examples of this uber luxury brands globally.
We are living in a world where luxury has become something that everyone can buy. And this is mostly because of social media. Young kids today, young girls today, ask their mothers or maybe fathers, easier to convince, to buy them a Cartier bracelet. Back in the day, that was something that maybe a 40, 50-year-old woman could aspire to. But they see it on social media, and this is what they want. And this happened in China maybe 10, 15 years ago, where the young kids, the millennials, Generation Z, have been spending or asking their parents to buy them luxury quite successfully. But it now came to the US. And in the US, young kids, if they have some kind of a budget or they have wealthy grandparents, and obviously the baby boomers are sitting on quite a big wealth in terms of their housing stock, and they can probably convince them to get some nice expensive gifts. So what has changed in the US is that that luxury has become much more popular and much more accessible in a way, even though the price points have been moving. Though a lot of companies have introduced, for example, Cartier, lower price points that also allow people to enter the brand. Chanel or Hermes is selling lipstick, which is sustainably sourced and it's refillable. And so there's a lot of things that consumers who research and look online, what's cool, what's available, follow celebrities, they look for those things. And maybe instead of buying five dresses from Zara, they just buy one thing from one of those brands.
I remember it somewhat at the beginning of the pandemic or in the early months of it anyway, you mentioned that as we are now forced to be in this position where we might know that we like a certain brand and therefore might look for it online rather than walk into a store that has many brands, for instance, you'd have to know the brand. How has it been for the rise of new brands one way or the other? Has it been quite difficult or?
I see it in, especially in makeup, because that's a category that's quite easy to enter. You outsource manufacturing, you get a pretty girl to advertise on social media. So we have seen a lot of new brands in makeup, but they come and go. Few of them, like for example, Huda Beauty, have some staying power, and those who have staying power, they probably will get acquired by someone like L'Oréal or Estée Lauder, but a lot of them fail and disappear. The same thing applies to apparel. We see a lot of them entering the market, but a lot of them disappear. And obviously, you need critical mass. And today, the sustainability issue that we have discussed, communication, the services that one needs to offer, it's a situation, internet creates a situation where there's obviously the barriers to entry are falling in the traditional way of thinking, the distribution, easy to enter. But the noise is such that internet actually creates an opportunity for the biggest, strongest, best executing brands. And we are seeing that, and there's only a handful of those. In the US, there's a handful of them in Europe, and they are getting stronger because they have the budgets. Obviously, they can also do things wrong and lose some of that power. But what I have been experiencing, and I think this will just continue, they do all sorts of collaboration to make it more exciting for consumers. And obviously that has massive implications for their financials because with scale, with global markets, with direct to consumer distribution, where you are basically selling to the customer directly, you don't need to share your profit neither with a retailer or marketing agency or TV because your site becomes your communication channel. So the dynamics are actually very, very attractive for the strongest brands.
Is it the same sort of being able to have critical mass, being able to have the budget and being able to have the scale and recognition? Are those the companies that actually are able to invest in ESG, in sustainability? I mean, Or, I mean, how does that work? If you were a player that perhaps wasn't as big, what type of investment are we talking about that companies have to make in order to sort of move themselves along into a new era?
These are big investments. These are billions. And obviously, the bigger you are, the bigger your scale, the more you can afford. And the more serious you can be about that, because obviously we are facing very serious issues, and consumption is one of, it's what drives the economy. 60-70% of GDP is consumption, but consumption is bad for the environment. So if companies don't do that, then the governments will try to regulate them. So I think they are trying to run ahead of that. But it creates a very interesting dynamic, because for those who do that properly, then many of them operate in fragmented markets, like L'Oreal has only 12% share in beauty globally. This share can increase if they can convince consumers that their products are best from ESG perspective, that their shampoo bottles are refillable, that the way they sourced it. And as a big company with a huge R&D budget, you can do that. It's very hard to do it for a small company and be credible. You have to outsource. You are at the mercy of a lot of people around you. So it is a process that actually allows the stronger get stronger. But they need to execute. They cannot just pretend. They cannot, you know, write all these ESG reports where they just tick the boxes to get the right ratings. Because I think the consumer will see through that quite quickly with all the information available on the internet.
Do you see debt fueling consumer spending, or is it mostly from savings? And I might add on to the overall discussion, are you noticing consumer goods being paid for by cryptocurrencies at this stage or in any meaningful way? So debt versus savings and also crypto.
I think what has been driving consumption is buy now, pay later. I guess as investors, we keep hearing about companies like Affirm and based on, even PayPal is doing it now. So I think that's helping, because that obviously that's credit that's easily available, in many cases very affordable. So I think there's an element of that, but also the savings, especially in the US, the consumers have never had so much in terms of savings at their disposal. So I think it's both. The buy now pay later, I think this is something probably what young kids actually are using and doing, but they probably can call on their parents or grandparents when it comes to actually. And that would be the way to deplete those savings.
Yeah, it's pay the credit card bill or the buy now, pay later. What about crypto? Is crypto anything serious within sort of, this is always the question, isn't it? Is it just an investment vehicle, or is it something you can actually use as a currency? Any thoughts?
I think it's mostly used as an investment vehicle, and many members who have it and watch them daily or minute by minute on the phone what's happening to the price. So it's a bit of I think it's still a bit of a hobby more than means of payment.
Okay, interesting. Just interesting to see what consumers are. So tell us a little bit about where in the sector you see particular areas of growth. And I don't know if that is also part of the way we'll be, you know, in just kind of a new world to an extent. What do we want going forward? And where do you see areas of real growth within the sector?
I think the growth, you know, COVID has accelerated lots of trends. The digitalization, the more awareness of our bodies and our spirits and the need to maybe slow down and think about our health. I think those trends, because it has lasted for so long, they are very well entrenched. So I think the healthy eating, the plant-based proteins, exercise and all kind of means of exercising, I think those things, the second-hand retail, there are lots of new consumer behaviors, or maybe not new, but consumer behaviors which got a boost, and I don't see them changing, because they are very kind of entrenched in the way people live now. Our homes have become very important to us, and and whether it's for home entertainment or working from home, but I don't think anyone will go 100% back to the office. So there is quite a bit. I am a bit puzzled looking at the auto industry, because there we are seeing now very strong demand, very strong prices of secondhand cars. But when you think about the future, and when you think about autonomous driving, and when you think about the need to change the vehicle park, it's obviously not an industry where one can say with conviction, yeah, there is growth there. I think it's an industry which kind of has been dying and got a boost. And question is, how will they use it? Usually it's end up with much more capex and much more competition down the road. So there are different segments of the consumption where different things, I think, will play in different ways. I think one needs to be quite selective investing.
Where does this fit within one's portfolio? How would you sort of recommend exposure broadly for many of the investors joining us here today?
And there are many companies like that, many consumer companies which have really good management, which have all the ESG issues properly sorted out. And I have a lot of them in the fund. The fund is really focused on companies which have strong intellectual properties, strong management. I also have some companies which are new in a way, because they are plant-based food, or maybe new e-commerce models in the resale world. So in the fund, I would say it's kind of two kinds of things, the best in class and the new things, which I think have chance of becoming best in class.
Fantastic. Anessa Winimko, it's fantastic to have a chance to speak with you. You're always on the cutting edge of everything. And so it's really kind of wonderful what you see that we're going to want down the road. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Goodbye.
That's Anessa Winimko joining us from London. Thanks for joining us. I'm Pamela Ritchie.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thanks again. See you next time.